You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Markaz al-Sahaba.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Business Matters with me, your host, Al-Amin Templeton. Well, it's the start of a new week, and the Rand has retraced some of its fantastic gains that it made last week in the wake of Moody's foregoing to bring the guillotine down on our necks. Despite some negative comments in the wake of all of that by Goldman, no, sorry, it wasn't Goldman Sachs, it was Standard & Poor's. It's funny, I kind of tend to get those two mixed up. Standard & Poor's and Goldman Sachs is basically the same kind of company, isn't it? No, let's not get nasty. But we must just point out that when Lehman Brothers went down in 2008, Goldman Sachs, Standard & Poor's had given it a AA rating just days before. Bear Stearns had just gone down in 2008, and a few days before it went down, Standard & Poor's had given a AA rating. AGI, the huge, big international insurance conglomerate that went down, brought down by collateralized debt obligations that were all kinds of snaky kind of things in them, low-income housing packages, little landmines sent all over the world. Banks didn't know what they were holding in the wake of all of that. AGI was selling that all over the place, and they were selling them on the behalf of Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs, no, even OCDs of Goldman Sachs wasn't selling it. It took out insurance on its own collateralized debt obligations and other people's collateralized debt obligations just to make like a lot of profit out of it. And then what happened? AGI went down, and Larry Summers, who was then head of Treasury, former chief executive of Goldman Sachs, who had put together the actual legislation that ensured that collateralized debt obligations could be sold in the first place, who knew everything about what was going on, he called AGI in and insisted that they pay out Goldman Sachs on 100 cents in the dollar, full recompense from a company that just declared bankruptcy. Can you imagine it? And Goldman Sachs got its money as well. Yeah, those guys know how to make their money. Okay, well, there you go. Your little bit of economic history for today. It's amazing now. That kind of stuff is now economic history rather than contemporaneous economics. It's funny, you know, back in 2006, 2007, how controversial all of that was. And now it's kind of like, you know, everyone pretends that they knew it was going to happen all the time. Oh, well, okay, well, let's go and have our tale of the tape. ShareNet website today showing that the four most watched shares on the JSE, the usual suspects, EOH, has got its results coming out tomorrow. People are worried. It says it's going to be down. It lost its contract to sell Microsoft products earlier this year in February when it was found that they had actually bribed government officials in order to get a defense contract. AOH says they're now revising all of their contract dealings and negotiation practices. They say everything is fine and they fired all the guys that were guilty. But nevertheless, they expect a knock. And nevertheless, today, its share price is 14% up. That may well be that, I guess, people on the JSE are kind of like betting that in actual fact, the share price had been far too depressed by the news that led up to its results, which are tomorrow. And that means when the results come out tomorrow, the share price should in actual fact recover. And so they'll be able to sell at a profit. So, well, anyway, good luck to them. Let's see if they're right or not. Well, actually, I shouldn't say good luck to them because that's just speculative buying. You're not in actual fact investing for the good and the bad as you're supposed to do as a Muslim. So you must be very careful, you know. As you're a Muslim, you want to go into the JSE. You'll see all of the other guys doing all kinds of things. Just because they're doing it doesn't mean it's okay for you to do it. You must know why you're there. If you want to go and get involved in the JSE, you must know why you're there, and you must know what you're doing. Steinhoff is in second place, second most watched share today on the JSE. Of course, also then for all the wrong reasons. It's been giving out special voting rights and so on to conformist shareholders in Europe, where they're busy trying to raise some money. So anyway, everyone's having a look at that and wondering, are we ever going to get any money out of Steinhoff? I guess the Dutch prosecutors, though, our hope has got to be with the Dutch prosecutors, because the Hawks over 1 year only managed to investigate one trade. Can you imagine it? And then they discovered there were another 10. There's more than another 10. There's another 10,000 shares they have to investigate. But hopefully the Dutch prosecutors have made more progress than our ham-fisted Hawks. We're not hearing much out of the weekly report backs they're supposed to be giving to Parliament's Oversight Committee. Anyway, maybe things will turn around there. Of course, the Hawks were saying, but we waited for PwC's report. And PwC's report comes out and it says, well, you know, they didn't maintain the correct auditing standards. They didn't say they were engaged in theft and fraud and all kinds of money laundering and so on. A very watered down kind of report coming out of PwC. And again, underscoring criticisms of these behemoths of the accounting world. Should accounting firms be allowed to get so big? Should there be a cap on the size of accounting firm or the amount of clients that they're allowed to have? A lot more kind of oversight is needed there, because, I mean, I cast my mind back to 1993 when the Nell Commission investigation into Masterbond came out. And it found that Ernst & Young's behavior in the course of the Masterbond saga had been atrocious, had very actively colluded with management in order to defraud pensioners of more than 600 million rands. And that was back in the 1990s, where the rand was actually still something. I can remember I wrote an article on it, and I was hauled in by the South African accounting guy, Saki. And they wanted to know from me, are you serious about this? You want to bring all kinds of other people onto who the accountants must report to? Who are the shareholders in a firm? It's not just people to hold the shares. It was argued it's the workers, it's the trade unions, it's the community, you know. So, you still have that kind of discussion going on everywhere around the world, but not really much being done about it. Fortunately, today we've got an interesting guest on the line, Professor Patrick Bond from Wits University. He's an economics professor and a very clever guy. Well, you will recall recently we mentioned that Eskom had been given a $180 million cash injection. They use these very nice words, don't they? A cash injection. Sounds like I've got a whole lot of vitamin C in my blood, from the New Development Bank to fund the integration of renewable energy into the grid. Where do they come with these stories? It's amazing. We've heard several explanations as to what this loan is all about. It's to fund the integration of the renewable energy into the grid. Oh, that sounds really nice. But a few days before that, they said, no, it's to fund a desulfurization equipment at Medupi. Now, the other people are saying, no, it's to augment transmission projects. A lot of smoke and mirrors around what amounts to, again, another international loan for Eskom. There was an even more controversial loan back in 2010. And on the line now, we are joined by Professor Patrick Bond, who's going to explain in detail just what is wrong with these loans and where the heck is Eskom taking us. Good evening, Professor. How are you? Hello?
I'm hearing you fine.
Oh, hi, Professor. Hi, Professor. How are you?
Great. Yes, just call me Patrick. It's great to be with you and the listeners, and it's a very good intro because, as you say, Al, it's on 2010, around April 7th that year, after four or five months of battle, the World Bank made its largest ever project loan, $3.75 billion, around about 52 billion rand, and it was from Medupi. And they did so after this campaign against the loan by a wide variety that ranged from grassroots groups. It actually began in South Durban with the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, with Earth Life Africa, with Groundwork. And then it even caught up the DA and the Business Day. And so really a wide cross-section of society said, why are you making the biggest ever loan for a coal-fired power plant at a time climate change was beginning to get onto the World Bank radar, but particularly because Hitachi had bribed the ANC through the investment vehicle Chancellor House of our ruling party, the African National Congress.
Yeah.
And that was out in the open. And in fact, the public protector had already told the chair of ESCOM, who was on the ANC Finance Committee, you remember his name perhaps, Vali Musa, he was also international IUCN president. So he's kind of a big weight. So when he was, in a sense, overturning a prior bid to do the boilers, and these are contracts worth over 50 billion rand, this was a big controversy, and it began to be clear that it was, in effect, a bribe. This is not controversial to allege because the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the United States was used to prosecute Hitachi, and they had an out-of-court settlement for about 280 million rand, $19 million. So this is not even a controversy that, if I say, Medupi is corruption-riddled, a plant that was supposed to cost 65 billion rand in total, and it went up, now it's over 200 billion.
Yeah.
And indeed, the public protectors found about 140 billion rand of corruption. So, yeah, we're talking about at the exchange rate of around 14 rand to the dollar, really about $20 billion of corruption associated with both Medupi and the partner coal-fired power plant.
That's dollars corruption.
Well, the dollars, I'd say the total corruption is in the range of about, 18 to 20 billion. And that's going to be for ESCOM carrying now a total debt of 420 billion, or around about $30 billion. It's very important to get the World Bank to cancel that loan. And ironically, just last Monday, the new World Bank president began his job. His name, David Malpass. And what we know of him is that he's a fool. He was the chief economist at Bear Stearns, the big investment bank, in February 2008. It went bankrupt.
We just mentioned them in charge of the show.
Yeah, scoundrels, right? Real banksters. And and the chief economist, his name is David Malpass, comes out of also Arthur Andersen. You know, he's been in all the...
With the Enron and all of that as well.
So this guy actually had written a Wall Street Journal article saying everything's fine, the world credit markets are great. So he's a foolish man. Mm. However, sometimes he gets it right. And in 2017, he testified to the United States House of Representatives Financial Services Committee. It's online. You can, listeners can check it out. It's quite interesting.
Mm.
And he says the World Bank is always making loans where they fly people first class to countries and they make corrupt deals, and then this benefits never trickle down to ordinary people. He just described Medupi. And then Maxine Waters, the representative who was running that committee, said, can you give us some examples? Do you have any? And he said South Africa. And it's obviously this is Medupi because it was the biggest by far. Nothing comes close.
Yeah.
Now that to me is the grounds for what is often called odious debt in the international legal terminology, a loan that just shouldn't have been made. It wasn't done with any participation. It's like our e-tolls here in Johannesburg, where they just kind of dumped them on people, and people rejected them, and the Austrian company involved and the Peristatal are having to dismantle them now. These are the kinds of disciplines from below that I think this government we have is desperately in need of much more of, an odious debt. The BRICS bank that you also mentioned, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa bank, made its first loan to Brian Molefe, the chair of ESCOM, who had to resign in a absolutely humiliating corruption riddled incident with the family called the Guptas, right?
Yeah, another sad litany. It's amazing.
Yeah. And so from there you go to the BRICS bank loans. Indeed, you listed some of the sort of bizarre, let me call them environmental fig leaves on these loans to corrupt companies. I'll just give you two others very quickly. One to ESCOM for lending for Soweto's electricity restructuring. And the people in Soweto, 85% are not paying because ESCOM has screwed up their bills and their services. And I know those activists very well, and they have a lot of integrity. And if the BRICS Bank is trying to lend in Soweto, they've picked a fight with the wrong people. The second, Al, is in Transnet's rigging of the Durban Harbor. It's only about 9-10 meters, and now with these huge ships, post-Panamax is their name because they carry more than the number of containers, 5,000, that would comfortably fit through the Panama Canal before it was recently increased. So now we're getting in Durban, much bigger ships, but they can only come in half full at high tide. So they need to dig deeper, and they're building up the port. Unfortunately, they've chosen people. I can name, you know, the name is an Italian company, but interestingly, in South Africa, the name is Sean Impisani, who is part of the deal. And of course that was corrupt. She's the most notorious character in Durban. And within 3 months, last November, within 3 months of this loan having been turned into an actual contract for this Italian-led construction team to deepen the Durban port, they had to cancel it. That's Paul O'Sullivan, a well-known whistleblower.
Yes.
So in that sense, we've got a very interesting track record for the BRICS Bank. So the South Durban leader, Desmond Desah, famous activist who won the Goldman Prize, the sort of Nobel Prize of Environment.
He was my tutor at university in sociology.
Is that a fact? Yeah, but, no, you're thinking of Ashwin Desah.
Oh, yes, Ashwin. I thought you said Ashwin, sorry.
Yes, and Desmond, who's even more of a maniacal activist than Ashwin, who's my co-author on a couple of books about we're putting out this year. Okay. But Desmond has been writing with myself to the compliance officer at the BRICS Bank to say, what's going on? Why are you just completely corrupt from day one? And they say, sorry, we have no compliance, basically. I can share the correspondence. It's one of those shocking things where we'd wanted this new BRICS institution to offer alternatives, to be different, more transparent, less corrupt, more environmentally conscious, more community-oriented, lending in local currencies. Every loan so far has been in U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
You know, the activities are really basically just digging ports. You know, you don't really need much in the way of imports for that. The extension of electricity transmission lines, basically all the local steel and labor. So in all of these respects, we find this BRICS Bank to be full of charlatans. And even the vice president that South Africa has put in, Leslie Maasdorp, who had been at Goldman Sachs, he'd been at Bank of America, he'd been at the privatization office, he'd been at the Lesotho Highlands Water Project when they were completely confounded with corruption. This is not the best foot forward from South Africa, and certainly not for the BRICS. It makes them look not like an alternative, but an amplifier.
Yeah, very much. It's like the same story being written over again.
It is. And the tragedy is that we've got in the BRICS now two proto-fascist leaders from 2014, Narendra Modi, and then from January, Jair Bolsonaro. And Bolsonaro has just chosen the chair of the BRICS Bank.
Yeah, how does
the Cape Town annual meeting.
It's like stepping into quicksand. You think it looks perfectly fine. Next moment, you're knee-deep in all kinds of stuff.
And in fact, if your listeners know the Daily Maverick e-zine, and they'll have seen perhaps one of their better journalists, Kevin Bloom, writing about this last week, and he mentioned that we've had some visitors from the other BRICS countries to do watchdogging. And this is one of those moments where the South African capacity to watchdog these scammers is critical, and we've shown it with Bell Pottinger. You can watchdog them and give companies like that the corporate death sentence, right? That's what they deserve, and Bell Pottinger got it. KPMG, with its nickname here, the wedding planners, they've been disinvested by all kinds of local clients. McKinsey, apologies, down on its knees. You know, we're talking about major international corporations, the South African civil society, our general citizenry, opposition parties are saying, get the hell out of here. What are you doing in league with the Guptas, the Sasas, the ANC leaders who are just rotten with corruption? And I think we need to do that with the BRICS Bank as well. It has given us every indication that they're as bad as you get.
Do you find it also strange, the new development bank coming up with all the reasons why it's given this loan? Very much kind of like following the same kind of pattern as the World Bank loan. No, it's going to be for clean air. It's going to be to scrub the sulfur out of the air. It's going to be integrating the renewable energy into the grid. You know, you throw a green label at it, and then you go and do whatever you like hiding behind that label.
Yeah, Precisely. It's greenwashing. It's a fig leaf.
Yeah, there you go. Very nice, too.
and indeed, when we've been raising this kind of critique, particularly because it's just another funnel to put money into an ESCOM which keeps building coal-fired plants and really has no agenda for especially ordinary people's access to cheaper renewable electricity with battery storage, with local socially controlled and worker self-managed electricity, the kind of thing that even though our metal workers, NUMSA, are opposed to the privatized electricity, they would support that. And we desperately need to move in that direction. And this is where the BRICS Bank is simply in league with this crew at the top of ESCOM who have no agenda for cleaning up their act. And therefore, Medupi, which is only half built right now, and if only the half of it that's built is only half effective, and Kutile is far from being built.
Yes.
These are plants that I think probably should be shut down, as even ESCOM's chair, Jabal Mbuza, hinted a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, yes. The board was actually discussing that very issue. Well, I think it was something like 18 billion rand each, 36
That's
billion
right.
rand in total. Yeah, too.
Well. In fact, the totals are coming into 220 billion rand each, and so what we're talking about in a way is just stop throwing. Yes, you're right. That's what they say is needs to finish them. But when you get operations that are so dysfunctional where they can't run the boiler, and basically eat up the production of electricity, otherwise they overheat.
Yeah.
And then we don't have any water for them. I mean, the Waterberg has got a few streams, Waterberg, but it really has not anything like the kind of coolant that are required. You have to actually import the water all the way from the Sutu.
So the site was in actual fact a non-starter from the beginning then, because I can't see. How much is it going to cost to get water from the Lesotho Highlands Water Project to Medupi?
And that precisely is the next loan from the BRICS Bank. And unfortunately, the corruption that began in the late 1990s, in which one of the key people, his name is Masuka Sole, from the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, the Trans-Caledon Tunnel Authority, to be precise,
yes.
He was put into jail for 9 years for massive corruption associated with a dozen major construction companies, one of them called Acres, was actually put to sleep. It was also like Bell Pottinger, given the corporate death sentence for corruption. It was really one of the most important corruption cases ever. Well, guess who's back as the Lesotho government's main envoy? Same guy, Masuka Sole. He's been back there about 3 years. This is a sort of systematic corruption at the top that gives all of these mega projects such a bad name.
I can remember at the time of the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, the whole lot of construction companies that were named, they were supposed to be removed from the lists of bidding for government contracts around the world. The World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the IMF, they're all going to keep a watch list of construction companies caught up in corruption and government contracts. So what happened to all of that then?
Well, exactly that process of it's actually called debarring, BAR, began with the Lesotho Highlands Water Project.
Yes.
So they knocked out one or two for appearances' sake. The biggest one is called ABB. It's the biggest construction company in the world. So they get off the hook because they're so big, too big to fail.
Yeah.
But then, guess what happens at the World Bank? They've then got so much corruption in these big projects that's coming to light, so they hire a vice president for integrity. Vice president integrity. But guess who gets the job? It's 2008. Somebody in this country needs
John
a job.
John Bolton. What?
No, you're close. His name's Leonard McCarthy. You remember Spike?
Yes,
Leonard
yes,
McCarthy,
yeah. Right? He
former
ended up
scorpion.
There. Oh, really?
He was, and it gets better than in a moment, Al. Just to remind you that in 2008, there was still a finance minister, Trevor Manuel, who was thought to be, maybe World Bank presidential material, if they were ever to allow a non-European to take the job of head of IMF or a non-American to take the head of the World Bank. And the point is that Leonard McCarthy needed a quick escape route in 2008 as it all began to fall apart, as Zuma came in, as he failed to use his knowledge of the 783 counts of corruption against Zuma, as in 2009, of course, those spy tapes with Bulalale Ngcuka meant that Zuma was sort of off the hook, according to the prosecutors here. And all of this was such a mess. So it turns out Leonard McCarthy just got away and got this top vice presidency at the World Bank. Then Musi Manmani, the head of the DA, asked him, it's all in writing, says, wait a minute, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission just fined Hitachi $19 million for corrupting us. But you, the World Bank, were part of this. Don't you think you need to do something about Hitachi and corruption and debar them, to answer your question? And what did Leonard McCarthy say? Nope, sorry, it's just not our part of the loan. In other words, he found a completely comical way to say it's not our business. And in a way, when you think of our failure on the Lesotho Dam, to also have South African prosecution of our own construction company, all these dead ducks were part of it, and also to fail to prosecute Hitachi for corrupting our government through the Chancellor House, it just shows that our leadership is so rotten with corruption they cannot turn the mirror inward. It would shatter with a complete destructive force that would take too many people down. It just means we've got to work much, much harder. We don't really have a new Ramaphosa government, do we? We've got a Ramazupta situation.
People are saying something.
Yeah, of way too many of the same characters rolling themselves through institutions, whether they be BRICS banks, whether they be top government positions, or the parastatals especially. We think with someone like Popo Molefe, as the chair of Transnet, that we're going to solve the problem because he hasn't been tainted. But on the other hand, he had the biggest loan ever to deal with, which was Transnet through Brian Molefe when he was in the head, getting $5 billion from the China Development Bank. And what was that for? For the China South Rail provision of 1,000 locomotives. And those locomotives had big kickbacks to the Guptas through Selim Issa. So you connect all the dots here. Unfortunately, Popo Molefe a couple of months ago gets angry because China South Rail isn't giving us decent locomotives, and we don't need so many. In fact, the main reason for them is to export coal from the Waterberg down to Richards Bay, the biggest single project in the country, 800 billion rand. So Popo Molefe goes, and already we've had about 40 billion rand in contract commitments on this $5 billion loan from China Development Bank to China South Rail. Molefe can only get 680 million back. It's so pathetic. So we've really got to keep the watchdogging going, because I fear that, after we've seen a sort of year of Ramaphosa, it's pretty evident that he needs a big left flank of critics in society, because we can't trust him to run serious anti-corruption. I would say Ramaphosa himself implicated in things like the illicit financial flows of Lawnmin to Bermuda, 1.4 billion rand, billions in illicit financial flows from MTN. Even the Nigerians have been able to catch them on, it's exaggerated claims, but MTN stayed fine. And then even Shanduka, Ramaphosa's own company, with illicit financial flows to Mauritius, caught in the Paradise Papers about a year and a half ago.
Yes.
This is an indication that the Ramaphoria, the Ramaphosians, really aren't looking under the hood. They're just accepting the shiny vehicle that, in fact, is the Scorokoro in terms of fighting corruption.
Yeah, sometimes the shine is all you have. What kind of good outcomes do you see for something like a Jubilee project to try and recover this money?
Well, the name Jubilee, if you have religious listeners who've got the sense of the...
We have a few.
the old Leviticus, the kind of crazy part of the Bible. It's every 7 years you've got to kind of have
a Jubilee.
Live fellow, right. And so you put seven of those 7 years, that's 49 years. And a very good movement led by Njem Kunkulu and Bengani, who was the Archbishop of Cape Town, taking over from Archbishop Tutu, and Dennis Brutus, late poet, fantastic, brilliant activist against apartheid and injustice. And they ran the Jubilee movement with very good staff and allies in the early 2000s. Unfortunately, they had a guy they were appealing to say, please rethink repayment of the apartheid debt, rethink the stance towards these big companies that made profits. And that was Thabo Mbeki, and he just completely blew them off. I saw that.
Repeatedly, the government, the South African government, intervened to block the Jubilee process.
Exactly, and it was the most frustrating thing for for wonderful leaders like John Bruton Mangani and Dennis Brutus. So the discussion that, in fact, was happening in Cape Town over the last couple of weeks about odious debt and about the ways in which you can legitimately make claims and also scare off lenders by saying, look, these loans that our government is contracting have not gone through a proper process. We need a parliamentary process, but we need consultation with the society. And we have a very fine group called the Committee to Abolish Illegitimate Debt based in Brussels. And the leader, Eric Toussaint, a very kind of world-class intellectual, has been in Cape Town based at Alternative Information Development Center, AIDC.org.za. So they're probably reviving this question of the massive debt. I might tell your listeners, they'll be surprised. We often talk about the public debt, which is usually the internal domestic debt of the South African government. The South African government has a small foreign debt, but the really big problem is not that. It's the foreign debt, the parastatal of Lumpus.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
And it's $182 billion, the Reserve Bank quarterly bulletin that was just released last month shows us. That, if you compare historically, it's unprecedented.
Yeah.
Do you remember there was a terrible moment? P.W. Botha shook his finger in the so-called Rubicon.
The Rubicon speech.
In Durban City Hall in August 1985. And he was so out of touch that the world financier said, this man is crazy. And the anti-apartheid movement said, let's start a run on these banks, Barclays, Chase Manhattan. And those banks said, sorry, P.W., sorry, Baron du Plessis, the finance minister, you've got to pay us back. And that caused a debt crisis. It caused Botha and du Plessis to default. And at the time, that caused, in turn, Anglo-American leader Gavin Reilly to go up to try to meet Oor Tambo in Zambia. And they had the beginnings, really, of the end of apartheid were in August, September 1985. At that point, our foreign debt was 41% of GDP. We're now at 52%. So we're higher in the level of sort of desperation, which is why even last January, a year and 3 months ago, ESCOM nearly couldn't pay its World Bank loan, and that would have triggered a mass default. We could go to the IMF. There's something in the BRICS called the Contingent Reserve Arrangement. But, you know, that's the kind of desperation that puts you in such a bad nick. We're already paying, by the way, our fourth highest interest rate in the world amongst the countries that issue 10-year bonds. There are about 50 countries. And of those, only Venezuela, which is just around the same as us, and Turkey, which is a bit higher, and Argentina, a little bit higher, they pay higher interest rates, in a way, penalty for being, you know, on the edge of default, junk-rated. And we're right up there. And I think we've really got to be questioning, what is the character of the foreign debt? Why are we borrowing so much quarter on quarter to repay earlier debt, but also to pay foreign corporations to export profits? And by that, I mean Anglo-American.
Patrick, what's the problem there? Don't South African banks have a lot of money? I mean, during apartheid, we built up like a huge big war chest of local savings.
Absolutely. You know, we have the biggest savings in world history in the form of the JSE. Now, don't take it from me. You've heard of Warren Buffett. The Warren Buffett indicator, is this market capitalization for the stock market as a share of GDP. We're about 370%. It's never been higher in world history. The sort of world level right now is about 130%, and which is also unprecedented high. So we're in a world situation where there's way too much savings, but it's in a casino. The JSE's capitalization, again, just by any ordinary measure, Buffett indicator, suggests that our corporates and our bankers and my pension fund managers have just been sloshing all of our liquid funds into a stock market and building a bubble instead of reinvesting in the society, because our gross fixed investment, you know, the plant, equipment, machinery, that's at a record low. We're at about 17% private sector, barely doing wear and tear. In other words, no new net investment.
Really. So they're not spending the money on bricks and mortar.
They're putting it into a JSE, which is bubbling up. It's still at the 58,000 mark, very, very high in relation to the real economy. And they're also putting it into interest-bearing assets. And, you know, we're all paying mortgage bonds and car loans, student loans. We're paying loans that are at incredibly high interest rates in relation to the size of the economy. Now, in order to get the interest rate lower, in order to rethink the outflow of profits that go to London, the Anglo, De Beers, Old Mutual, FAB Miller, now Anheuser-Busch, these big, big companies that ran away, you have to do something that is very controversial. These two words I'm going to say never are allowed up for discussion in mainstream discussion. The two words are exchange control. That means making sure that the money stays in the country. If you say, but Patrick, those two words are so controversial, you can't say them because they're obviously the source of awful, awful destruction. I would say, no, Al, it's the opposite.
Yeah, look at Malaysia in the wake of the Asian flu.
Precisely. It was in September 98 when there was a run on the Malaysian currency. Mm. In fact, it's now the same president, Mahathir Mohamad, in power again. And he was able to stop the run by putting on exchange controls. But even our own example, just 11 years ago when we had the terrible world financial meltdown, it was because we had 85% requirement on our pension funds, our insurance companies, our what's called institutional investors today. It's a pool of 10 trillion rand. Mm. And 85% of that had to be invested. And you can ask everyone from Brian Cantor to Johan Rupert, all the way to the left to Jeremy Cronin, all are on record saying, thank goodness we had exchange controls that kept the money in the country. Otherwise, our bankers would be gambling abroad. And the tragedy is since then, we've liberalized and we've gone down from 85 to 70. So any of your listeners who might be, you know, investors, institutional managers, they're licking their lips because they know they can just take out of every rand we give them 30 cents and put it into some other casino. The problem is those casinos go bankrupt faster than ours. And with this liberalization, we're much more vulnerable to another bout, which I think is coming sometime soon, of world financial turmoil. And so I would love a discussion of those two dirty words, exchange controls, because these guys, including our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, have abused exchange controls. They have illicit financial flows of around 250 billion rand a year over the past decade or so, according to Global Financial Integrity. Hey, that's money that we desperately need to be circulating to lower the interest rate to get investment going here.
Patrick, I'd actually love to discuss that issue with you. Maybe we can get onto that issue in, maybe next week or the week after. And maybe in relation to, could South Africa do quantitative easing?
And I would do it in a less quantitative way going to the banks, the way the Federal Reserve did. And the more qualitative way going to ordinary people, because if we could have a debt holiday, a forgiveness on some of these crazy loans. You know, we had a company called CPS Net One, whose major investor, by the way, was the World Bank, 22% in Serge Belamonte's civil operation. Well, then they put their fingers deep into the pockets of the poorest South Africans. 17 million grants go out every month, and about 13 million go for children. And yet 5-year-old children getting microfinance, getting cell phone contracts, because Serge Belamonte's CPS Net One was popping those poor people with loans and debit orders. And we had to eventually throw them out because Black Sash and the victims were raising hell about it. So that's the kind of discussion we need, is to say what can be done to discipline these wilding financiers before they create such enormous chaos. And I think, you know, you get very little discussion. You get people in daily life defaulting on their debts, blacklisted, in a miserable situation where the repo man, the repossession man, are coming around, credit the debt collectors. And I think we've really got to confront that and have an open discussion in society. Why do we let the financial system go out of control? Why did the 17 banks that were ripping off South Africans through currency manipulation were never regulated by the Reserve Bank and the Treasury?
And why doesn't Business Day write about it?
Hey, because they're caught up right within it. Competition Commission is our last hope to have some discipline, because I'd say if the question is why is a Business Day, a Treasury, and a Reserve Bank, all, let me call them, state captured by three brothers. I don't mean the ones in Saxonwold. Mm. I don't mean the Watsons. I mean the three brothers in New York City, Standard & Poor's, Fitch & Moody's. those guys have really captured so much of our policy, and that makes it, you know, subject to the whims of world finance. It means, I think we desperately need this kind of discussion about whether more sanity can be returned to regulation of banks. And that has to come from below.
Well, I was just reminding our listeners at the beginning of the show, as we started, that to Goldman Sachs and the ratings agencies that rated Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers as double A just days before they went down. AGI was triple A rated, and I think it was Lawrence Summers insisted that they pay 100 cents in the dollar to Goldman Sachs for the insurance on the very collateralized debt obligations that Goldman Sachs had sold to their own clients, and they bet against them and in the insurance, and then they got their 100.
And Goldman just got caught again in Malaysia in the last few months for doing the biggest scandal ever
RMB in
the government. That's right. And I think the thing here is you've got a very smart guy running Goldman named Colin Coleman. Comes from an anti-apartheid family, Max Coleman and Audrey Coleman, and the brother is leading trade unionists. You know, it's a very interesting family, but it's so sad that the Goldman Sachs can say what they like about the way things should work here without society raising the question, aren't you the same characters who wrecked the world economy just 11 years ago?
Yeah.
Have we really forgotten your role? Why do you have any legitimacy to say anything at all?
Because the government keeps on appointing them.
It's true, and it's an ideology. It's an ideology of neoliberalism, of big corporate. And it's really time we got back to the old Keynesian approach. John Maynard Keynes had such a different perspective, a perspective that sometimes he said, for the rentiers, the only solution is euthanasia. In other words, you really got to put financial repression, another phrase he used. Mm. That's why we need exchange controls. He said that's the single most important thing you can do for economic management is exchange controls.
Sure. Okay. Patrick, thank you very much for your time and for sharing your thoughts with us. It's been most illuminating. God willing, in maybe next week or the week after, we can have that discussion on exchange controls. I'd actually love to do that.
Let's have a debate.
Yes.
See somebody from the bank who would have a heart attack, and that would be good to experience to have a good debate with them. Yeah. Thank you so much, y'all.
Great, thank you very much. That's Professor Patrick Bond of Wits University. Giving us a lowdown, if that's possible, on Eskom and the World Bank and the New Development Bank, that's the BRICS banks, cash loans to them, more money, threatening to leave our country. We're sitting on a huge cash pile here, distance between government and the corporate sector. You can say justified, unjustified. Nevertheless, we've got a huge, big yawning chasm between our corporate sector and our government. That distrust has always been there. That element of distrust has always been there since 1994. It's something that we've never really managed to banish. And that credibility gap between government and the corporate sector is something that continues to hurt this country. If you consider that the United States will go to war over bananas, you go and look up the United Fruit Company. Go Google the United Fruit Company. Go and find out what America, the United States, is willing to do for bananas, let alone something far more strategic like oil. The entire nations in South America have been decimated. That means reduced by one tenth by America's policies. Very often, to bolster the price of bananas or to ensure that they have a steady rubber supply. It really is quite shocking, the things that people are willing to ignore in the interests of chasing after the mighty dollar. That's almost brought us to the end of the show today. The JSE finished 14.02 to the greenback this afternoon. Peregrine Treasury Solutions says the Rand is trapped in a very tight range. The market's risk has been driven by an upbeat start to the U.S. earnings season, while positive signs from the Chinese economy are also assisting the Rand. I kind of felt that the wire services had been priming the markets
to have a good outlook on America by saying, yeah, our banking stocks are going to be reporting. And now the banks have come out, you know, they're just sitting there with $5.5 trillion worth of quantitative easing, $1.3 trillion worth of TARP that has come their way in the last decade. I mean, how could they else not be anything but extremely healthy? So, that's boosted the world markets today slightly. Positive signs from the Chinese economy also coming through. The futures 500, the S&P 500 fluctuated as Goldman Sachs paired gains in the pre-market of the missing estimates for sales and trading revenue. I'm always glad when I hear Goldman Sachs has been doing badly. In Asia, equities advanced to a fresh six-month high, propelled by markets in Japan, Korea. That's after the Bank of Japan released upbeat credit data. Chinese trade and leading data showing signs of improvement for the world's second biggest economy. Investors are turning to U.S. earnings season, confirm the resilience of corporate America in the face of numerous challenges and growth. J.P. Morgan Chase, yes, that's the same company that went down, and J.P. Morgan took them over, put Chase on the end of it. Posted first quarter strong results. Bank of America is also up today. So central banks remain in the picture. Donald Trump renewing his attack at the weekend on Fed leadership, saying the U.S. stock market would be 5,000 to 10,000 points higher if it hadn't been for the actions of U.S. policymakers, like the president of America. He's also a policymaker, you know, but he was actually speaking about the Fed. Saying that the Fed should actually, instead of starting to tighten, starting to reduce the amount of bonds that was leading into the market. In fact, the U.S. Fed has only recovered $500 billion only since it started issuing that easy money into the markets. Not allowed into the retail level, however. It's all been enjoyed by the banks and their friends on Wall Street, all chowing down on that. The banks then had to use the money to go and buy treasuries, which are government bonds, government debt, U.S. government debt. And then the people who bought the treasuries, easy treasuries, were able to take that money invested in the stock exchange. So they made sure that the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. None of it trickled down to a retail level. So when Patrick Bondi is speaking about we could do a quantitative easing in South Africa, but we'd have to do something that would reach the ordinary people. It's very interesting, you know, if you have a look at what at the bailout of the Japanese banks in the wake of the Asian flu in 97, basically the Asian flu in 97 was started by the Japanese property bubble. You had a whole lot of politicians and businessmen getting together. We've spoken about it in the show before, how you can value a piece of land. You can say, okay, this land over here is just a piece of felt. Today it's worth 1.5 million rands. This is what happened with Master Bond. This is actually a case study I'm taking you through, Langebaan. This is just an empty piece of land. It's worth 1.5 million rands. Okay, well, we'll sell it to ourselves. We'll sell it to a property development company. This property has just been bought by a property development company. The property development company intends putting a whole lot of expensive stuff on this land. This land is now worth 15 million. So one day it's worth 1.5 million. The very next day it's worth 15 million, simply because a whole lot of guys who already own the land have said now they're going to sell it to their own property company. Now you take that land and you go to the municipality and you get it rezoned for development purposes, and then you immediately say that this land is now worth 150 million rands. Then you start selling debentures in the land, in the property, which is still exactly the same piece of property, windswept with felt grasses and a little bit of sand, you know, with the waves lapping, very cold gray and gray sky, bleaky outlook. Same piece of land. And like in a matter of weeks, you can have that land worth 150 million rands. And you start selling debentures into that land. And now you want to use the money from the debentures to start your development. So you start your development, but now building has to take time. You know, once you get the buildings built, then you have to try and sell the buildings to people. You have to find people either to rent or to buy your property, like Club Mykonos and so on. And so that takes time. So you're not actually making any profit. You're only going to start making profit when, you know, you've got the rentiers and the buyers coming in. But right now, you've got a whole lot of people buying debentures expecting monthly interest payments. So you start taking new debenture money coming in and using that to pay the interest on the old debentures. And so you turn into a pyramid scheme. So you get really desperate. Then you take your company to the stock exchange. You go and speak to a national minister and you get some politicians on your side. You get your cousin. You got a cousin in the Reserve Bank. In fact, the registrar, deputy registrar of banks was related to Perrin, one of the master bond directors. It's a very nice kind of business, you know. And so you go, you make sure the Reserve Bank and all the authorities don't clamp down on your illegal business. You take it to the stock exchange, and your piece of land, which has hardly changed shape, is now worth $1.5 billion. That is what property and all of this nonsense can do. Have to be very careful about these things. Well, hopefully we'll cast that small little pencil light of a little halo onto the darkness in the world, and hopefully we've given a little bit of illumination with today's show. Jazakumullah for joining us. I make dua that whatever trading activity you got up to today has been profitable and above all halal. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, Allahu akbar. لا شهد أن لا إله إلا الله لا شهد أن محمد رسول الله لا شهد أن لا إله إلا الله لا شهد أن محمد رسول الله هو الله الذي لا إله إلا الله هو الرحمن الرحيم Subhanallah, alhamdulillah,